Volcano Watch. This is a usually weekly podcast to update you on the volcanic activity of the week. I'm one of your hosts, Corinne Jorgensen, and my co-host, Alessandra Musa, is on a well-deserved vacation. We're PhD students at the University of Geneva. We study volcanoes, and we're here to give you all the hot volcano news. But we're still on summer vacation, well, mix of summer vacation and a lot of field work and some other fun analysis, beam times thrown in there. So you get a midsummer special today. As part of my field work, I was in it, had the chance to go to Martinique in the Caribbean in May as part of a CUSO field trip. And with that, I got to interview one of my colleagues from the University of Geneva, Dr. Alan Fries, to talk to him a little bit about Mount Pelee and also about his research and his thesis, which he had just recently defended. It's a little bit of a long episode, but it was a really cool interview, and I think you guys are all going to like it. So just to set the scene, imagine yourself on a nice Caribbean beach. There's waves going in the background. You have toes in the sand, and you're chatting with a friend about volcanoes. Okay, hi everyone. I'm here with Dr. Alan Fries, who just finished his PhD at the University of Geneva. Him and I are in Martinique right now. We're doing a field trip related to our university and some of the other universities here. Hi Alan, how are you?
Fine. I'm in Martinique on the beach near Montpellier, so I'm fine.
It's all good. So you're from Martinique?
Yes, so I grew up here in the south of Martinique. I was not born in Martinique yet. But I spent most of my life here.
And you finished your PhD in Geneva?
I just finished. It was like 2 weeks ago.
Yes, very good. And you do physical volcanology?
Exactly, yeah.
Very cool. Okay, so we're on Martinique, and Martinique is home to?
Home to many things, actually. But I think what you are thinking about is the most famous volcano, which is Mont Pelee. Well, just to give you the context, so Martinique is a subduction island, so it's in a volcanic arc that is called the Lesser Antilles, so this is in Central America. And, so in Martinique, you can see different stages of the construction of the arc, and it's a very good place to study the evolution of volcanism in the Lesser Antilles. So during the field trip, we saw the first rocks that erupted, that are dated at 25 million years old. And then we went to the most recent part, which is Mont Pelee. And today we did a great hike to see the lava domes constructed during the 1902 and 1929 eruptions. And so when you look at the rocks, they start on the east side of Martinique. And as the subduction progresses, you have more recent rocks toward the west part. And so Mont Pelee is in the northwestern part of the island, and it grew up very recently. So it's hard to give an age because there was a previous edifice, but we usually say that the one that we can see now is dated at 125,000 years before. And it has several stages of collapse. So when we look at the volcano, it has a very specific shape. Like the morphology is quite uncommon because of these nested collapses. And when you do the hike, I think you will remember, you have to climb all the different stages of collapse and then walk on the rims.
Up and down and up and down.
Yeah, yeah. So it's quite a funny hike because you don't just go up. You go up, find a collapse, then go down, then go up again, and finally to the lava domes, which are, well, hard to walk on,
yes.
Would you reckon?
definitely, but very fun.
But we didn't lose anyone.
No, not quite.
Yeah. So, if you want me to talk a bit about Mont Pelee, this is my favorite volcano, of course. It's why I wanted to do volcanology.
Yeah.
Because when I was a kid, I used to go to Saint-Pierre, that is a town that got destroyed in 1902. Killing almost 30,000 people. And I was really, really interested to know how we could manage to prevent that in the future. So that's how I got really interested into volcanology.
Ah, that's cool.
Yes, yes. Not for the people who died.
Oh, of course not. No. But it's a very altruistic motivation to get into volcanology. I think lots of people get into it because it's cool with explosions. So really, I don't know. I think it's a nice thing.
Also, yeah. I'm proud about Martinique because I'd like to call it the place where physical volcanology was born.
Okay.
As after the eruption of 1902, there was a very good survey done by Alfred Lacroix from the French Geological Survey at the time. So he went and described the eruptions. So he described the pyroclastic flows for the first time. He described the growth of the lava domes, of also a lava spine that grew after the eruption. So those are the first very precise descriptions of the volcanology in Martinique and also around the world. So I really like to think that this place where I grew up is the start of physical volcanology. Others may not agree, but I like to say so.
Nah, I think that's really cool. Okay, can you tell me about the eruption that happened in 1902?
So it was a catastrophic event, mainly for three reasons. The first one being that people stayed in town because there was an election at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, in a sense, requested to stay so that they could vote for the deputies of Martinique. The election was supposed to go on 11th of May 1902, but the eruption took place in 8th of May 1902.
Mm.
So this is one of the reasons why people were asked to stay in town. And the other thing is that we didn't know about this type of eruption. So people, they expected ashfall or lava flows, but not something that quick and that powerful that completely destroyed the city.
Because Saint-Pierre is how far away from the summit? It's like...
I think it's... it's very close. It's
within 5 kilometers?
No, within 10 kilometers, okay. I would say 6, 7.
Okay.
So that's why... Okay, so the pyroclastic flow, it happened... Well, it's not clear yet, but either because of a lateral blast of the volcano or because of a collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So it can happen as a lateral blast when... it's depressurized from the side of the volcano instead of from the summit. Or it could happen from collapse if a lava dome collapses and depressurizes the magma below,
mm-hmm.
that triggers a pyroclastic flow. So the pyroclastic flow during this eruption, it flew mainly in a valley that is north of Saint-Pierre,
mm-hmm.
1 kilometer north of Saint-Pierre, about that. And the dilute part actually overcame the topography and flew in Saint-Pierre, destroying the houses and, killing many people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was only one guy who survived inside the city.
Really?
He was in jail. In a very thick jail.
Wow!
So the guy survived and he was found, I think, 1 or 2 days later, buried in ash, like with only his head coming out of the ash.
What?
Inside his jail.
Oh my god!
So he's called the Cyparis.
Wow.
And so this guy is known as one of the only survivors. And most accurately, like, he's known as the only one who survived inside the town.
The city, okay.
There are other ones that saw the eruption, but they were higher up in the town, so they didn't get, like, the surge.
Okay, yeah.
Basically.
So, but they learned from their mistakes, right? Because there was another one in 1929, right?
Yes, there was another one that didn't do any casualties. And this one was the same type of the 1902, so it was basically phases of dome growth and collapses. And at the end of these two eruptions, two lava domes grew inside the crater of Mont Pelée,
mm-hmm.
and now they are the summit of the volcano.
What we climbed today.
Yes, exactly. So we climbed today Mont Pelée. Well, it was very cloudy.
It's a beautiful view, beautiful view.
It was horizontal rain. but it was nice, at least, because we saw the lava domes. And at the top of the lava dome in 1902, as I said before, an andesitic spine grew. And this grew nearly vertically. So it raised as a column of andesite at the top of the volcano, and I think it reached a maximum height of about 300 meters above the lava dome. So at that time, Mont Pelée was around 1600 meters high. Now it's 1400 meters high.
Okay, lost some altitude.
See the difference.
Yeah.
And it fell actually pretty quickly, so it collapsed several times actually, because there were phases of growth and collapse. So now it's gone, and we can only see the remnants at the top.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we worked on it today.
Yeah.
We worked on history, as I like to say.
Ah, beautiful. And so nowadays, well, during the 1902 and the 1929 eruption, was there observatory at that time or no?
No.
Okay, but now there is.
Now there is. So the observatory is one of the oldest in the world, I think just after the one in Vesuvius.
Okay.
It got built in 1935, and it's in activity since then continuously. Now what they do is that they survey both the volcano, tsunamis, and also earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
All of those being main hazards in Martinique, and we have also to include floods and hurricanes that are not geology related.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so Mont Pelée is not only known for this type of pyroclastic flows. We saw on the field together during this field trip some deposits of Plinian eruptions.
So, can you define for our listeners what a Plinian eruption is?
So, it's called Plinian because it was observed by Pliny during the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 after Christ. And these eruptions are very large explosive eruptions that produce columns of pyroclasts that are injected high into the atmosphere. And these pyroclasts, they are then dispersed by the wind and fall on the ground at distances that depend on their density and size, mainly. So we saw these deposits. So these eruptions can be sustained. So they can be sustained for durations of hours to days. And the ones in Martinique are quite large. So between 0.2 and 1 cubic kilometers. So they have been recognized in the past. So we found about 5 of them. So in the last 3,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be even more. So if you look at the geological record for the last 10,000 years, well, I may be mistaken, but I think it's around 10 Plinian eruptions in these times.
That's a lot.
So that's a lot. In the field, when you look at them, they look like breccia containing a lot of pumices,
mm-hmm.
well sorted. And so this has never been observed since Europeans came to Martinique. However, the pre-Columbian civilizations, they experienced it, and we find often ceramics and traces of their lives inside the deposits of
Plinian
eruptions. Yeah,
oh,
it's like Vesuvius. So there is an eruption that is called P3.
Okay.
It's the third most recent Plinian eruption.
Okay.
And it's exactly the same age than the Vesuvius eruption. It's 79 after Christ.
Okay. It's a big year for volcanoes.
Exactly. And this one is 1 cubic kilometer in volume. Columns reached around 25 to 30 kilometers.
Yeah.
And unlike Vesuvius, again, it had stages of stable columns and of collapses that filled very large pyroclastic flows around the volcano. So that's where we can find remnants of pre-Columbian civilizations.
Oh, very cool. Huh.
Yeah.
Is this the 1625 eruption? No, that's a later one.
Yeah, that's a later one. That one is called P1.
Okay.
So that's the one that occurred just before Europeans came, so around 200 years before they came.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a story, well, we don't really know where the name of Mont Pelée comes from, but one of the story I heard was that when Europeans came, because this Plinian eruption called P1 was so close in time, the mountain, like vegetation on the mountain didn't grow again. And it looked peeled. So peeled is pelé in French. And
So it's Mount Peeled.
It's Mount Peeled, yeah.
Like a banana.
And if you look at it, well, we can't see it now, but if you look at it, the vegetation at the top is very short. So it really looks peeled, no?
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why they call this mountain like that. It's weird because if you see the other volcanoes in the Les Antilles, they are often called Soufrière. Mm-hmm. So you have Soufrière de Guadeloupe, Soufrière mm-hmm. de Saint-Vincent, Soufrière de Sainte-Lucie.
Why is that?
Because it smells like sulfur.
Ah,
Soufrière
okay.
means
so...
sulfur origin, you know, like where you find the sulfur. So that's why they just called all the volcanoes like that. They didn't have imagination, you know. And Montpellier is quite unique for that.
Yeah.
It has a proper name.
They're like, it doesn't smell like sulfur, looks like a peeled banana.
Yes, so right now if you look at the volcano, you don't really see signs of activity.
Okay, yeah.
There are no fumaroles. The last one stopped in 1970. There are hot springs, but those are hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the side of the volcano. And
but there's been some seismic unrest.
Yeah, basically that's it.
Minor seismic unrest.
Yes. Let's not... I don't really
minor.
Know about like, that. But. So it's just that when you look at the volcano, it's at rest, basically. Then now it's in a vigilance zone, which means that there are signs of unrest. And...
But this just means more or less that the Volcano Observatory will just
exactly
continue to do what they're doing and let us know if anything changes, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yes. Yes. So it's just like they raised the alert level so that people know that something could happen in the timescale of years to...
Hundreds of years.
Yeah, exactly.
At some point in the future.
Exactly.
Whether or not humans are still alive at
something
that point.
Something could happen.
Something could potentially maybe happen.
Exactly, yes.
Very cool.
Let's not be alarmed.
So can you tell us a little bit about your own research with your PhD?
Oh, you just finished it. So I'm working on Tephra fallout. And Tephra, they are volcanic rock fragments that are produced during explosive eruptions. So these are injected into the atmosphere and then they fall at speeds that will then determine the distance at which they deposit from the volcanoes. And it's important to know that in order to improve how we manage to mitigate the risk linked to Tephra fallout. So I've been studying particular Tephra fallout features, and in particular ash fingers that are, well, currents of ash that descend from volcanic clouds at speeds greater than the individual fall velocity of volcanic ash.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, these can enhance the settling velocity of volcanic ash,
mm-hmm.
and this needs to be taken into account into models if we want to improve how this hazard is forecasted.
And so you look at volcanoes, because I know your colleague Jonathan, he does modeling of this, but you yourself, you do the field work of this side? Or?
Yeah. So I did the field work and the experimental part.
Ah, okay.
So with the field work, the idea was to go at several volcanoes that are currently erupting.
Which ones?
It was first Sabancaya in Peru, then Sakurajima in Japan. And we got videos from the local observatory in Mount Etna.
Ah, okay, cool.
So these are the three main ones. We also did a survey in the Canary Islands, so at Cumbre Vieja Volcano. But well, this is still work in progress. I didn't process the data
fair
yet.
Fair enough.
So I do that. I do the field work. So basically, I film the eruptions. And then from these visual observations, I try to define the vertical speed of these ash fingers and also the distance at which they form, the height of the plumes, and all of these data, they can help then to constrain the properties of ash fingers and the conditions for which they form. Because for the moment, this phenomenon is not really described,
mm-hmm.
so it's poorly known. And we really need to improve how it's described in the natural system, basically.
Okay, I'm just going to chime in for a little bit of context. So first things first, an important idea in physical volcanology, which is like the study of like the physical products that come out of volcanoes, is that you get big and heavy particles closer to the vent or the crater or the volcano, and then the smaller particles settle further away because they have more time. They're lighter, they can stay in an ash column for longer, they can fly further away. So this is like an important idea. And this idea is important because you can use this to try and figure out like the mass eruption rate of the volcano, and in historic eruptions where we didn't get to see how high the eruptive column went, you can back calculate how high the eruptive column might have been from this kind of stuff. So understanding these processes is really important, but of course if you have other processes that will change that, then this is important to know as well. So this is a little bit what Alan is talking about.
Do you think you'd be able to see that in like the deposit? Is it just like in the grain size distribution, or?
Very good question. Okay, it's a bit complex because it's not the only collective settling mechanism.
Okay.
So you'll often also find volcanic ash that settled within aggregates. Mm-hmm. So those are just particles binded together by electrostatic forces or capillary forces. And because of that, so these particles form large aggregates, mm-hmm. that fall faster than
they would if they were just single ones.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they usually break upon impact. And what you find is that fine particles are transported closer than expected, along with the coarse particles that are expected to fall at this location.
So the fine particles might have been an aggregate at one point.
Yes. So you find bimodal grain size distributions linked to aggregation. But this can also be explained by ash fingers that will transport volcanic ash, so finer than expected, at locations close to the edifice. And because of that, so these fine particles are settling closer than they would individually. And we may also find bimodal grain size distribution. And in fact, in all the field cases that I know of, so every time they saw fingers, there was also aggregation. So it's hard to distinguish between the signature of aggregation and ash fingers, in a sense.
Fair enough.
It's possible that the two play at the same time, the same role.
Yeah.
Because they are both size selective and they affect the same sizes.
So tricky.
Tricky to distinguish. And that's why another part of my PhD is to perform laboratory experiments.
Ah, okay.
Because with experiments, you can really control all the parameters that are inputs of your model.
So what materials do you use for the experiments? Is it water, it's syrup, it's...
Yeah, so my experiments are done in water.
Okay.
So it's a very simple setup. It's just a particle laden water layer at the top, and then a denser sugary layer at the bottom. So the one at the top, it mimics the volcanic cloud, and the one at the bottom, the denser atmosphere below. And we just remove a barrier that separates initially the two layers at the beginning, and we can see particles falling into the lower layer. So we also see fingers that form quickly and descend into the lower layer. So then we measure their properties and also vary the input parameters in order to find the conditions for which fingers form. So one of the things that we can do also with experiments is that we can use multiple imaging techniques in order to see, for example, the velocity of individual particles.
Oh, wow!
To, for example, also see the density of the fluid, how it varies with time, but also the particle concentration. And all of this is, well, I would say impossible for volcanic clouds.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, let's say very tricky. So yeah. I'm not delusive, you know?
Yeah. One day it might happen.
Yeah, because you have techniques. For example, the LIDAR, you can measure the particle concentration in a way. You can also try to fly a drone in a volcanic cloud or to do something. But it's much easier to do that in a laboratory experiment where you can control the parameters.
Yeah, of course.
And vary them as you wish and repeat the experiments as you want. So that's the second part of my PhD, and I should talk also about the part of Joe, who is doing numerical simulations, and he targeted specifically, well, first he reproduced my experiments, so that was quite cool and hard to do at the beginning, because he needed to build a new model, a new numerical model, in order to model this phenomenon. And then he added multiple more complex processes. So he added aggregation into the model to see how fingers and aggregation interact within each other. So his results are very cool. It shows that even without aggregation, you can get bimodal deposits with hash fingers. And it shows that aggregation might occur within hash fingers. So there may be, you know, like a link.
A coupling of
the two. Of the origin of the two processes. So, well, I'm not saying that aggregation only occurs in hash fingers. It can as well, yeah. Because it mainly happens in the volcanic plume that is very turbulent. What else about my...
Well, do you have any... what were your results from your research that you found the most exciting, that you were most interested in?
I think the field part, because it was really, really poorly described. And so with the studies that we've performed, it was possible to observe much more fingers than before and to define the grain sizes that they can transport. The deposits at the distance at which they reach the ground, and also their vertical speed. So basically, I think that this is the most interesting part, as it opens a lot of it opens a wide range of possibilities now to investigate this in the future using multiple techniques, different techniques, and. And yeah, so I think it's very cool.
Yeah, super cool. Do you have any other things you want to add?
Yes, I want to add also that my PhD was not only on Tetra Fallout.
Sure,
actually,
yeah.
It was like one and a half thesis, because I had another big part on Tetra remobilization by the wind.
Ah.
Which, just to say quickly, we went to Sabankaya, so and we filmed the eruptions, but we also collected remobilized particles, and as well we filmed the remobilization events.
So can you explain what a remobilization event is?
So these are when Tetra are deposited, they like the superficial part of Tetra deposits can be remobilized by the wind. So it means that they can be put again in motion. This can happen because of various mechanisms. So they can just do small hops like that we call saltation. They can roll on the ground, we call this creep or rolling, or they can also get suspended. And this means that they will enter into the atmosphere and travel for a long distance again, even after their deposition. And this can happen even, well, millennia after an eruption. So you have deposits that are very old, that are still remobilized by the wind, triggering secondary hazards that will extend both in time and space the primary hazards of Tetra Fallout. So this is a...
it's a big risk for populations living close to volcanoes.
It's a big risk for population, also given that this is repeated. So remobilization will depend on atmospheric conditions, so the wind speed, the temperature, the humidity, of course also the deposit properties. Well, so their humidity as well, their grain size. And if you have enough material, you can trigger very large remobilization events. So there are, for example, pictures from satellites where you can see large remobilization clouds. And these look actually like primary volcanic plumes. So it's a big hazard that was often not considered.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think the volcanology community knows much more about it. And so with my thesis, the idea was to look at a specific setting where you have at the same time at Sabankaya regular explosions that will provide new tephra and remobilization. So it was quite an interesting setting to study. Also, we tried a bit of new techniques to characterize the particles. And in the end, I think it's an interesting piece of work.
Cool, very cool, nice. Okay, good. Well, we like to ask when we interview people if they could name a volcano, what they would name it. So do you have any ideas?
Okay, I will do like the European that came to the Les Antilles. I have no imagination.
Okay.
I would call it Souffrière de Martinique. I have no imagination.
Amazing. Amazing. Thanks so much for letting me interview you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks.
I just want to say one more time, thanks so much, Alan, for this really cool interview. We're still in our midsummer break. We might try to do a what you've missed volcano-wise in the next few months, but things are still a little bit busy for a while. But we're looking forward to getting back into the usual groove of things come September. Hope everyone's summer is going really great and they're not melting too much in the heat and just channeling their inner volcano and being hot. Okay, that's all from me. Bye, guys.
Bravo!